Chapter 2. That, if they had been in Brandt's drawing room, he might almost have tried to disprove her deduction. Don't you see, she continued, that there are men enough to say pleasant things to me, and that what I want is a friend who won't be afraid to say disagreeable ones when I need them? Sometimes I have fancied you might be that friend. I don't know why, except that you are neither a prig nor a bounder, and that I shouldn't have to pretend with you, or be on my guard against you. Her voice had dropped to a note of seriousness, and she sat gazing up at him with the troubled gravity of a child. You don't know how much I need such a friend, she said. My aunt is full of copybook axioms, but they were all meant to apply to conduct in the early 50s. I always feel that to live up to them would include wearing book muslin with gigot sleeves. And the other women, my best friends, well, they use me or abuse me, but they don't care a straw what happens to me. I've been about too long. People are getting tired of me. They are beginning to say I ought to marry. There was a moment's pause, during which Selden meditated one or two replies calculated to add a momentary zest to the situation, but he rejected them in favor of the simple question, well, why don't you? She colored and laughed. I see you are a friend after all, and that is one of the disagreeable things I was asking for. It wasn't meant to be disagreeable, he returned amicably. Isn't marriage your vocation? Isn't it what you're all brought up for? She sighed. I suppose so. What else is there? Exactly. And so why not take the plunge and have it over? She shrugged her shoulders. Why you speak as if I ought to marry the first man who came along. I didn't mean to imply that you are as hard put to it as that. But there must be someone with the requisite qualifications. She shook her head wearily. I threw away one or two good chances when I first came out. I suppose every girl does, and you know I am horribly poor and very expensive. I must have a great deal of money. Selden had turned to reach for a cigarette box on the mantelpiece. What's become of Dilworth? He asked. Oh, his mother was frightened. She was afraid I should have all the family jewels reset, and she wanted me to promise that I wouldn't do over the drawing room. The very thing you are marrying for. Exactly. So she packed him off to India. Hard luck, but you can do better than Dilworth. He offered the box, and she took out three or four cigarettes, putting one between her lips and slipping the others into a little gold case attached to her long pearl chain. Have I time? Just a whiff, then. She leaned forward, holding the tip of her cigarette to his. As she did so, he noted, with a purely impersonal enjoyment, how evenly the black lashes were set in her smooth white lids, and how the purplish shade beneath them melted into the pure pallor of the cheek. She began to saunter about the room, examining the bookshelves between the puffs of her cigarette smoke. Some of the volumes had the ripe tints of good tooling and old Morocco, and her eyes lingered on them caressingly, not with the appreciation of the expert, but with the pleasure in agreeable tones and textures that was one of her inmost susceptibilities. Suddenly her expression changed from desultory enjoyment to active conjecture, and she turned to Selden with a question. You collect, don't you? You know about first editions and things? As much as a man may who has no money to spend. Now and then I pick up something in the rubbish heap, and I go and look on at the big sales. She had again addressed herself to the shelves, but her eyes now swept them inattentively, and he saw that she was preoccupied with a new idea. And Americana, do you collect Americana? Selden stared and laughed. No, that's rather out of my line. I'm not really a collector, you see. I simply like to have good editions of the books I am fond of. She made a slight grimace. And Americana are horribly dull, I suppose? I should fancy so, except to the historian. But the real collector values a thing for its rarity. I don't suppose the buyers of Americana sit up reading them all night. Old Jefferson Grice certainly didn't. She was listening with keen attention. And yet they fetch fabulous prices, don't they? It seems so odd to want to pay a lot for an ugly, badly printed book that one is never going to read. And I suppose most of the owners of Americana are not historians either? No, very few of the historians can afford to buy them. They have to use those in the public libraries or in private collections. It seems to be the mere rarity that attracts the average collector. He had seated himself on an arm of the chair near which she was standing, and she continued to question him, asking which were the rarest volumes, whether the Jefferson Price collection was really considered the finest in the world, and what was the largest price ever fetched by a single volume. It was so pleasant to sit there looking up at her, as she lifted now one book, and then another from the shelves, fluttering the pages between her fingers, while her drooping profile was outlined against the warm background of old bindings, that he talked on without pausing, to wonder at her sudden interest in so unsuggestive a subject. But he could never be long with her without trying to find a reason for what she was doing, and as she replaced his first edition of Le Briere, and turned away from the bookcases, he began to ask himself what else he had been driving at. Her next question was not of a nature to enlighten him. She paused before him with a smile which seemed at once designed to admit him to her familiarity, and to remind him of the restrictions it imposed. "Don't you ever mind," she asked suddenly, "not being rich enough to buy all the books you want?" He followed her glance about the room, with its worn furniture and shabby walls. "Don't I just? Do you take me for a saint on a pillar? And having to work, do you mind that?" "Oh, the work itself is not so bad. I'm rather fond of the law." "No, but the being tied down. The routine. Don't you ever want to get away, to see new places and people?" "Horribly, especially when I see all my friends rushing to the steamer." She drew a sympathetic breath. "But do you mind enough to marry to get out of it?" Selden broke into a laugh. "Gee, God forbid," he declared. She rose with a sigh, tossing her cigarette into the grate. "Ah, there's the difference. A girl must, a man may if he chooses." She surveyed him critically. "Your coat's a little shabby, but who cares? It doesn't keep people from asking you to dine. If I were shabby, no one would have me. A woman is asked out as much for her clothes as for herself. The clothes are the background, the frame, if you like. They don't make success, but they are a part of it. Who wants a dingy woman? We are expected to be pretty and well-dressed till we drop, and if we can't keep it up alone, we have to go into partnership." Selden glanced at her with amusement. It was impossible, even with her lovely eyes imploring him, to take a sentimental view of her case. "Ah, well, there must be plenty of capital on the lookout for such an investment. Perhaps you'll meet your fate tonight at the Treanors'." She returned his look interrogatively. "I thought you might be going there." "Oh, not in that capacity. But there are to be a lot of your set: Gwen Van Osburgh, the Wetherills, Lady Cressida Raith, and the George Dorsets." She paused a moment before the last name, and shot a query through her lashes, but he remained imperturbable. "Mrs. Treanor asked me, but I can't get away till the end of the week, and those big parties bore me." "Ah, so they do me," she exclaimed. "Then why go? It's part of the business, you forget. And besides, if I didn't, I should be playing bezique with my aunt at Richfield Springs." "That's almost as bad as marrying Dilworth," he agreed, and they both laughed for pure pleasure in their sudden intimacy. She glanced at the clock. "Dear me, I must be off. It's after 5. She paused before the mantelpiece, studying herself in the mirror while she adjusted her veil. The attitude revealed the long slope of her slender sides, which gave a kind of wildwood grace to her outline, as though she were a captured dryad subdued to the conventions of the drawing room, and Selden reflected that it was the same streak of sylvan freedom in her nature that lent such savor to her artificiality. He followed her across the room to the entrance hall, but on the threshold she held out her hand with a gesture of leave-taking. "It's been delightful," And now you will have to return my visit. But don't you want me to see you to the station? No. Goodbye here, please. She let her hand lie in his a moment, smiling up at him adorably. Goodbye, then, and good luck at Bellomont, he said, opening the door for her. On the landing she paused to look about her. There were a thousand chances to one against her meeting anybody, but one could never tell, and she always paid for her rare indiscretions by a violent reaction of prudence. There was no one in sight, however, but a charwoman who was scrubbing the stairs. Her own stout person and its surrounding implements took up so much room that Lily, to pass her, had to gather up her skirts and brush against the wall. As she did so, the woman paused in her work and looked up curiously, resting her clenched red fists on the wet cloth as he had just drawn from her pail. As he had a broad sallow face, slightly pitted with smallpox, and thin straw-colored hair through which her scalp shone unpleasantly. I beg your pardon, said Lily, intending by her politeness to convey a criticism of the other's manner. The woman, without answering, pushed her pail aside, and continued to stare as Miss Bart swept by with a murmur of silken linings. Lily felt herself flushing under the look. What did the creature suppose? Could one never do the simplest, the most harmless thing, without subjecting oneself to some odious conjecture? Halfway down the next flight, she smiled to think that a charwoman's stare should so perturb her. The poor thing was probably dazzled by such an unwonted apparition. But were such apparitions unwonted on Selden stairs? Miss Bart was not familiar with the moral code of bachelor's flat houses, and her color rose again as it occurred to her that the woman's persistent gaze implied a groping among past associations. But she put aside the thought with a smile at her own fears, and hastened downward, wondering if she should find a cab short of Fifth Avenue. Under the Georgian porch she paused again, scanning the street for a hansom. None was in sight, but as she reached the sidewalk she ran against a small glossy-looking man with a gardenia in his coat, who raised his hat with a surprised exclamation. Miss Bart? Well, of all people! This is luck, he declared. And she caught a twinkle of amused curiosity between his screwed-up lids. Oh, Mr. Rosedale, how are you? She said, perceiving that the irrepressible annoyance on her face was reflected in the sudden intimacy of his smile. Mr. Rosedale stood scanning her with interest and approval. He was a plump, rosy man of the blonde Jewish type, with smart London clothes fitting him like upholstery, and small sidelong eyes which gave him the air of appraising people, as if they were bric-a-brac. He glanced up interrogatively at the porch of the Benedict. Been up to town for a little shopping, I suppose? He said, in a tone which had the familiarity of a touch. Miss Bart shrank from it slightly, and then flung herself into precipitate explanations. Yes, I came up to see my dressmaker. I am just on my way to catch the train to the Treanors. Ah, your dressmaker. Just so, he said blandly. I didn't know there were any dressmakers in the Benedict. The Benedict? She looked gently puzzled. Is that the name of this building? Yes, that's the name. I believe it's an old word for bachelor, isn't it? I happen to own the building, that's the way I know. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.